WFSU Public Media now presents a delayed broadcast of A Conversation on Race, hosted by the Village Square. This community discussion took place on November 14, 2019, in the Junction at Monroe. And now to introduce the program, here's discussion moderator Brad Johnson.
Allow me to set the stage for what we're going to be talking about, and I know you saw the wonderful video. So, at the National Museum for Peace and Justice in Montgomery, Alabama, known informally as the Lynching Museum, there is a marker that says Leon County, Florida. It has four names on it. The names are Pierce Taylor, McMorris, Richard Hawkins, and Ernest Ponder. African Americans in Tallahassee and Leon County, Florida, did not escape the horror of lynching that plagued the nation during the 19th and the 20th centuries. There were four fully documented victims of lynching here. Though, of course, the true number remains unknown and likely others went undocumented. Pierce Taylor in 1897, McMorris in 1909, and teenagers Richard Hawkins and Ernest Ponder in 1937, these four African Americans accused of committing crimes against whites were taken from the Tallahassee jail and murdered by parties unknown. A group of whites hanged Taylor from a tree in the jail yard before shooting and killing him. In 1909, a small but determined white mob brutally beat Morris before hanging him from an oak tree in the jail yard. Around 3:30 a.m. on July 20, 1937, four masked white men kidnapped teenager Hawkins and Ponder from jail, took them outside the city limits, and shot each of them multiple times. Placards left at the scene of the Hawkins and Ponder murder warned African Americans to stay in their place. These atrocities, they sent a message of terror to African Americans and throughout the African American community. No one was ever arrested. No one was ever charged with the murders of Taylor, Morris, Hawkins, and Ponder. So we'll go ahead and begin this conversation. We have Bland, we have Byron, we have Ms. Takesha, in that order. And so we'll start. We'll say, Bland, can you tell us about the Tallahassee Remembrance Project, which is centered on much of what I just discussed? Thank you.
Sure, I'd be happy to. I am a parishioner at St. John's Episcopal Church, and it is one of the early partners in this coalition. So what I thought I would do is tell you what the mission... Oh, you can't hear?
Yeah, just pull it. Oh,
man. As they say, can you hear me now? Okay. What I thought I would do is tell you about the mission of the Community Remembrance Project, the genesis of the project, and then quickly the three specific objectives of this project. And that would be a good way to kind of to kick off and frame the rest of the discussion. So we do have a mission statement for the Community Remembrance Project, and it's actually a mission. We've been working on this since late 2017, early 2018, and we didn't actually write our mission statement until a couple of months ago. And it's actually very important to have done that, and it's now posted on the website. But I'm going to read you the mission statement. The Tallahassee Community Remembrance Project seeks to remember and acknowledge the past and present racial violence and injustice in Tallahassee, Leon County, Florida, and to inspire our community to come together for dialogue, education, understanding, action, and ultimately for healing and trust. One of the things we talked about in an early draft of the mission statement was reconciliation. And it was pointed out to some of us on the drafting committee that reconciliation assumes that we ever were united, that we ever were one. And so we can't really be reconciled if we were never a united community. So we actually took that word out and realized that what we have to work on is healing and trust and coming together. And some of us have to acknowledge and admit that we never were together. And a big reason that we never were together was because of institutional racism. So background of the project. The genesis of this project was a newspaper story from Nashville, Tennessee, concerning an Episcopal church in the Diocese of Tennessee that established a memorial in June of 2017, and their efforts to remember Nashville lynchings that occurred between 1892 and 1924. I was one of the co-conveners of Do Justice, which is the social justice ministry group at St. John's Episcopal Church. And we learned about that effort, and then we sought approval from St. John's vestry, the leadership there, to approach other community partners, especially faith communities, to explore the possibility of assembling a task force to bring a similar project to Tallahassee. And so we began to reach out first to other downtown churches, and then Byron will talk in a little while about our community partners, so I won't steal his thunder on that. So I've covered the mission statement, I've covered the genesis. The objectives of the project are, one, to erect a memorial plaque remembering African-American victims of Leon County lynchings. Number two, lead a service of repentance, reconciliation, and healing. I think we need to think about that word reconciliation some more, but that's the current objective. And three, organize events in perpetuity that would serve as an educational and informational foundation and catalyst for remembrance of the atrocities of the past and the present, acknowledge the challenging and difficult work of racial reconciliation through teaching, engagement, and action. In the early phases of this project, we did some informational meetings around Tallahassee, and like I say, we didn't have that overarching mission statement. We would list our three sequential objectives, one, two, three. And one of the things that we realized is people began to think that they were listed in some order of primacy, and that what we wanted to do was place a plaque in the ground and be done with this exercise. And so we've tried to communicate really clearly since that time that these are equal objectives, and in fact, if anything, the third objective probably has primacy, because it's all about the conversation, it's all about education, it's all about using this project simply as a catalyst for action, and a recognition that the project isn't the final action or the ultimate goal. So that's kind of the overview.
Thank you so much for that overview and providing and letting us know exactly like what was the origin of this project. And so I'm gonna go to you, Byron, because I want to know, like, what was the process for the group? You know, what type of processes did you go through as you all kind of worked on this project?
Well, process, it was slow, to say the least. But when I say slow, it means it took a little bit longer than we anticipated. We did not think we would still be in the process at this point. But I think it's a good thing that we are. We came to a point where we recognized that some adjustments needed to be made. As we started to invite others to share in this journey with us, we wanted to make sure that we had a good cross-section of representation from our entire community, and we're still open to having more partners, organizations to join us. Right now, we have about 29 partners consisting of faith-based organizations, community organizations, and the two universities that are supporting us and supporting this effort. So we're trying to make sure that we get the voices of as many people as we can, and we want to make this truly a community activity. So the process did consist of, you know, sort of starts and fits. You get a good stretch, or you reach out to people, and many start to say, yeah, we want to be a part of it, and then you reach out and you get somebody that says, oh, no. And those are, you know, there were some surprises. I won't call any names, but there were some surprises. And so it made us have to go back and think about what we're doing, why we're doing it, and also then consider why someone may or may not want to be a part of this effort. And so one of the things that I try to continually put into the atmosphere is that, you know, we have to understand that, again, everybody is not going to be with this project. But we have to, you know, we have to continue to value everyone as a person, and respect their opinions. And so it doesn't mean we stop what we're trying to do, but we don't need to think less of anyone because they don't want to be a part of this. We don't want to seem to be self-righteous in that way. So we want to make sure that people are on board for the right reasons and all of that. So that does slow you down a bit. But that's where we are today. And so we look forward to continuing and broadening our base. And, you know, this type of gathering, these types of activities, the Community Remembrance Project, as well as gatherings like what we're having here, are really good for us to be able to come together and have talks and understand. And one of the things that, and I know I'm going a little bit off your question, but one of the things, but since I got the mic, but it does allow us to really investigate, you know, other opinions and other thoughts. And one of the things that I truly believe is that, you know, we have to understand context. You know, even with our history, I mean, there are the facts that are there. But, you know, sometimes people's responses, people's feelings and opinions about what we're doing, you know, we have to look at the context. You know, one of the things that I brought up in an earlier discussion was, you know, we often want to, and I may get in trouble, but it's okay, looking for the exit. you know, especially, let's say, with white people. And one of the things I have come to realize is that there may be a need for white people to have a place in a space where they can really talk about this. Because I get the feeling that oftentimes either they feel, and sometimes maybe even black people want all of them to say, okay, well, we disown and we look badly at, you know, our ancestors who may have been, however you want to see it, on the right or wrong side of history, and want them to almost disavow themselves of their heritage. And I don't think that's right. I don't know that I could do that for my own, even if I knew something bad happened to or happened by one of my relatives. I could disavow the act, but that's a hard separation. So I think we have to look at some of these things in context. And, you know, I don't want to go too far, but, you know, Civil War is what it is. It's part of our history. And there are people in here who have lineage that goes back to those who fought, you know, for the South. And to, you know, say, well, you know, you got to disavow yourself from your great-grandfather because he fought on the side of the Confederates, it's hard to do. And we have to understand that and allow for that, and then to see how can we then come to a place where we can have mutual understanding. And then there's examples on the other side in terms of what I think, you know, white people may need to understand when it comes to black people. We'll get that later in the conversation, but I just want to put that out there.
I'll take notes.
Thank you, Byron, and for explaining the process that you all went through. And I'm sure processes like this, I mean, it's still going on. It takes work. You mentioned the partners. You're very sophisticated. I don't know if you all caught it. He kind of like sophisticatedly like pitched you. Did you catch that? We're growing. We have partners, and the list is growing and growing. Y'all caught that, right?
We want all of you.
We want you. Enlist. So, Ms. Takesha, how are you?
I'm all right.
You doing fine?
I'm doing all right.
So this project kind of took a foot, and then you saw what was going on, and you jumped in. What motivated you to be a part of this program?
Well, project? I had been aware of EJI, Equal Justice Initiative's initiative to put forth the Legacy Museum and the Memorial for Peace and Justice, actually a couple years out from the groundbreaking ceremony. So I had been anticipating this unveiling, and some friends of mine, we went the grand opening weekend in Montgomery, Alabama, and we toured both the museum and the Peace and Justice Memorial, aka the Lynching Memorial, where you see the pillars representing each county thus far, representation where there are known recorded lynchings. According to this vast study that EJI has done currently, I think about 1870, a little bit shy of the end of the Civil War, to 1950. And when I saw Leon County's pillar there, and I saw the graveyard beyond the hanging pillars that resemble the bodies, the strange fruit that we know from our lynching history, I was determined to bring that home. And so when I got back, I had shared it with some of my friends, said, hey, I'm gonna reach out to the community and see how we can retrieve this. I want Leon County to embrace its history and do what we need to do, our due diligence. I don't want people to keep coming to this museum and see our pillar just out there. So a friend of mine forwarded me an email that was a news article, Tallahassee Democrat, showing me that St. Michael's and Angels and St. John's had already began that work. So I quickly reached out and got in touch with Byron and Father Keelan and then Sandra Howard and Bland, and that's how I got involved.
Wonderful. Thank you. Thank you so much. So this question is for each of you or whomever might want to go ahead and ask. Apparently this project has been more complex than you might have originally thought. What are some of the pushbacks that you might have received? Byron's chuckling.
Land?
Well, one of the things that we learned, and this is... it began as a faith-based initiative, and it was born of religious conviction of the initial partners. And yet, since Sandra Howard and I were the ones who saw that article from Nashville and were kind of the co-conveners of the group, the two of us got together, and we're relatively task-oriented and sometimes pretty linear people, and we were asked to write an implementation plan, and we were going to wrap this puppy up in 12 months. And we had all of the action steps and the milestones worked out. And we were not real smart, but we were at least smart enough to have a draft watermark on it. But we basically came up with an action plan like I do for a project at work. And I think a corrective we got fairly early in the project was, y'all, you're not on Sandra and Bland's time. This project's going to be on God's time. And so, as Byron mentioned, we actually had to kind of slow down because we thought we were being clear and providing a lot of information. And we were providing a lot of information, but we weren't necessarily providing a lot of conversation. And that was a really important corrective. And to be able to listen to the valuable insights and concerns that were expressed by both white folks and black folks. So that was, and we talk about it being painstakingly slow, and it's taking us a long time, but one of the things we've realized is the project isn't the plaque, the project isn't the service of repentance, the project isn't even the educational campaign, the project is this process. Because I got to know Byron and I got to know Takesha and a lot of other people that I would never have met, and I got to have some of those challenging and a little bit scary and very transformative conversations with them.
I wanted to also add, you know, I was approached, I'm a member of St. Michael and All Angels Episcopal Church, and so when the project came to our attention and was asked if we would participate, you know, I believe my first response was why, you know? Something like this on the surface seems to be almost a slam dunk. Why wouldn't you want to do something like this? This is good. And remember, you know, atrocities that have happened, or at least acknowledge them, so forth and so on. But, you know, I realize that for different people, it may mean different things. And immediately I thought about, you know, for black people in general, I feel like, you know, it's almost like if we remember when we were kids, most of us who didn't grow up with the internet used to go outside and play, and you always had a scar on your elbow or sore or on your knee, and you break that scab, and how bad that hurts. Well, I felt like this could possibly be like that for some people in our community. And so, you know, I'm not surprised if there's some pushback or if people don't want to talk about it, don't want to be involved. And I just wanted that to be clear because, you know, as much as, you know, I'm not speaking for all black people, but I'll just, since I am of that hue, you know, you would think that this would be a good thing for us to do. But I do realize that, you know, it is painful. Mm-hmm. And it's something that you can't just put on a timeline and say, we're going to complete this project by XYZ, because there's a lot that has to happen.
So that's, I want to harp on that last line that you just kind of said and ask you that when you talk about the variances between blacks and whites, and obviously y'all talk to a lot of people throughout this process. I'm sure you've done a lot of research, so give me an idea of some of the reactions you've heard from people of both, you know, of color, people of black, people of white. So give me some of the dialogues that you can kind of look back over the time of working this process and say, here's some of the things that we heard, here's some of the things that I felt as I heard responses as we began to kind of build. Any thoughts coming to mind immediately?
Well, I know, now I wasn't at this particular event, but at least one of the meetings did get a little stirred up, I believe. I had a flat tire and it was raining. Maybe it was a good thing I couldn't get there. but, you know, and apparently there was some pushback, and even some of it was by African-Americans who wanted to really be sure, I assume, that this project was motivated in the right spirit. And even talking to one or two people who were apparently there, you know, even had my own blackness question. So, you know, it does run deep, and it does, I don't want it to get personal, but, you know, things like that do happen. And so there is significant pushback in some ways. Some people just don't want to deal with it, say, why do we need to deal with this at this time? Others may have doubt as to, you know, the validity of what we're doing. Case in point, and I know you're trying to ask another question, but
you got
the mic. But, you know, I went on a trip to Montgomery this summer with members of St. John's and St. Michael's, and we went to a church service on Sunday when we were wrapping it up, and someone, you know, we told them why we were there and what we had been doing. It wasn't said to me, but it was said to one of the people that was traveling with us that, you know, oh, they just made all that stuff up. And, you know, that's so hurtful. You know, you have people that still deny. You know, and it was a church where they still had Jefferson Davis's pew and the plaque. Well, they had moved it, but people, they lost members over that because they moved the pew out. So this still runs deep in many ways.
And I would say with a subject, a topic so dense, so important, and dealing and talking with people on it, I'd say trust is a big thing, right, Takesha? Would you think so?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah, I think you can't have true trust, I mean, trust without relationship, right? Without some kind of consistent or at least semi-consistent engagement, a knowing, a level of intimacy, a level of true concern and shared understanding of humanity or struggle, or at least an openness for empathy, for the truth, you know, no matter how hard, for confrontation. And so me being a part of the project too, and all of us having similar, if not the same desire, but maybe different ways of going about it, coming from different backgrounds, we've had to work on our relationships with each other and get to know. And those bus rides we've made or to Alabama this past summer. Like one of the trip I went on, one of our most committed members, Debbie, she put together this wonderful trip for us to go to Montgomery. We were the first group that went this summer, and we most of us drove a charter bus, and we sat next to people, some we didn't know, and we had the opportunity to grow and to learn and to talk. And so I was really privileged, and that built a level of trust to kind of break down those walls, even if it's gradually. But that's where it starts, that openness to build relationships so that you can build a level of trust. Because I don't know anybody who's, if you don't have a relationship or at least a willingness to open up, how are you going to have that trust?
Thank you. So this question is also for the panel, and then we're also going to open this up for anyone in the audience to weigh in. So this is a good discussion, okay? So this year, the New York Times created a program called the 1619 Project, which was organized with the goal of examining the legacy of slavery in the United States, timed as the 400th anniversary of the arrival of the first enslaved people from West Africa. So my question is, tell us about your experience around the tension between remembering, rewriting, and also reliving.
I would say there is tension there. Mm-hmm. I went to the museum in Montgomery, and I just held up in my room for about 3 hours before I spoke to anyone. It was a very moving and arresting type of experience. And it just, I didn't know what to think when I came out. And I almost felt captive in there. It seemed like it started closing in on me after a while. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I didn't want to leave, But it was just a difficult thing to accept and to see, and to see all of the things that have happened. Mm-hmm. And so it did put me in a different frame of mind. And it's mm-hmm. so very difficult to wrestle with, to grapple with, to think about, and to even express. I'm probably still having trouble expressing exactly what that was. But to see man's inhumanity to man in that way is deeply disturbing.
Yeah.
But I know that we can be so much more than that. I know we can be better than that. I know that didn't have to be the history, but unfortunately it is. So how do we go forward?
Mm-hmm. Would you say that there are any lessons, like any profound lessons, or maybe some that weren't that deep, but it just kind of said, oh, that was pretty, I didn't think about it that way, that you learned from this, or I would say even continuing to learn from these experiences in the process project?
I think the thing that surprised me the most, and I think we've had this conversation, mm-hmm. was, our white counterparts, to be honest. Many going through that museum, going through the memorials and other areas that we went to while we were in Montgomery, and how many said, I never knew all of this. Mm-hmm. And to me, mm-hmm. And surprisingly, we had one person who was about 85 years old who actually lived in Montgomery, and she said, I had no idea this was going on. And I'm wanting to say, what the hell do you mean you didn't know?
Right.
You didn't
right.
see something? Mm-hmm. Now there's something out there that you had to see.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so that's a hard wall to have to climb. Mm-hmm. How do you get that person to then come around? Mm-hmm. And so I think we deal with some of that. And again, I believe there's a space and a place that maybe white people need to be able to talk about and really think about it, instead of just saying, no, I don't want to deal with that, or no, I don't remember it. Maybe you do, maybe you just didn't realize it at the mm-hmm. time. And then also think about why you see some of the dynamics that you see in black communities or amongst the black race here. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I could go further, but I'll deal with that later.
Yeah.
Anyone from the audience have any input that, okay?
I just want to add that I know oftentimes we talk so much about us talking, blacks and whites talking with each other. And granted, we definitely need to do that. But I would like to propel white people to talk amongst yourselves about these issues more so, because blacks do it a lot, and some of us may can do it more so, but I think that's healthy, and in holding each other accountable in those same hue circles, but also in the opposite, because that's where the growth is going to happen, because there's going to be certain conversations or depths of conversations that would probably be best in sometimes the same circles, that someone black may not be able to tell you, or vice versa. And so I think that, because I think that sometimes is very challenging, at least for some of my white friends, when I talk to them, it's hard for them to talk sometimes to their family members or people and kind of check people when they're not as conscientious about these topics or wanting to engage them.
And to think that, I've heard people say, well, it wasn't me, mm-hmm. That type of response that you get. And no, it wasn't you per mm-hmm. se, and we're not necessarily here to point fingers at right. you. But, history is what it is,
right.
and we have to recognize that. And so maybe some conversations need to take place so that we can have a more productive engagement with one another. The idea is that we want to have a better community. We want
right.
to have a better country.
Mm-hmm.
And, it's not that we're going to start pointing fingers at mm-hmm. you. If we as black people hadn't, had an uprising yet, over this.
That's true.
It is what it is.
Mm-hmm.
So we're here, and we would love to have an engagement that is productive.
Mm-hmm.
But, it's hard to engage someone if they're going to deny or just turn it back.
Mm-hmm.
And all we want to do is be able to have a communication with one another.
I think we had a question from the audience or comment.
The brother over here said he went to St. Michael's Episcopal Church.
I attend there now. Yeah.
Well, I grew up in St. Michael's.
Mm-hmm.
And the Father David H. Brooks.
Yep.
About the parish house, right?
Yep. He recruited me as an acolyte.
There was a time when...
And I remember.
St. John's didn't want to have anything to do with black people.
That's true.
I mean...
Mm-hmm. We were born out of St.
Yeah,
John's.
Yeah. We have to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
Even the institutions that are represented. St. John's, before that big fire, was built with slave labor.
Mm-hmm.
And you go to their website, I don't think they even acknowledge it. The Bank of America caused legions of black people to lose their homes in that subprime mortgage scandal, going all the way back to 2008. So I think a lot of time in dealing with these institutions, we aren't really honest. And in regard to lynching, I think we have a very narrow definition of lynching. Because if, for example, if you consider Tallahassee Memorial Hospital, they would allow people to die. That goes back to 1948. It didn't start letting blacks into the hospital until 1965. They would rather a black person die than be admitted to the hospital. And some of them did die. And those blacks who died because TMH wouldn't let them in, well, let me tell you something. They're just as dead as if they had been lynched. Somebody needs to put up some kind of memorial for all of the blacks who died because TMH wouldn't let them in. And it goes on and on. There's no end to this. If you look at infant mortality, are any of y'all from Leon County?
I am. Born and raised here.
Okay, if you look at infant mortality in Leon County, black babies in Leon County die at about 4 times the rate of white babies. That being the case, those black babies are just as dead. Just as dead. So I think part of the problem is that, a lot of these dynamics continue even today.
Mm-hmm.
They aren't being addressed. They aren't spending their spend a whole lot of money on Cascades Park, but they don't spend a whole bunch of money to try to keep these black babies alive.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we have
so we have to get real here.
Thank you. We have another comment or question that's here.
Yeah, I just wanted to say to Dr. Hollifield that one of the things that Bland read out at the beginning was that our mission statement is to acknowledge the current racial injustice and violence that's happening. We know, and certainly research has showed that the levels of cortisol that, you know, blacks experience in their life, probably because of the systemic racial prejudice that's there, is in some ways the part of what happens with our black infant mortality. Those people are not able to have the kind of healthy systems that the rest of us who don't have all that stress in our lives take on. And it's part of what we hope to do with this project, is to acknowledge the things that are not talked about.
Right.
Thank you. You have someone right here and then here. Now, y'all forgive me if I can't see. I got glasses on and it's kind of dark. Can we kind of rotate the lights on?
I think in the community, I'm not really from around here. I'm from Manhattan. I moved down here about 20 years ago. So I see a lot of different, you know, cultural perspectives only because of, you know, because I've been around, whatever. But I think what the world needs now, it doesn't even matter about black and white or green. I'm half Indonesian. Hell, if they look at me, they say, why are your eyes so slanted? Oh, my God. I'm just saying, what we need is love. Now, if you are a community-based, you faith, you go to St. John's, wherever. I don't care if it's Beth Israel, whatever, wherever you go, wherever you praise the Lord and get yourself down on your knees and hope for the best in mankind while we're alive. We're not here. We have finite numbers. So people, let's get it together. Every day, take one step, and that step is love. That's all we need. That's all we need. More conversation.
Brad, if I may say...
Here. Okay,
one,
go ahead.
Yeah, I just want to make a comment. The gentleman, and I appreciate what you shared, and I agree with you about love, and Debbie's right about our mission statement. Lynching... You're right. We tend to have sometimes we just focus so much on the noose, right, or on the murders. Sometimes it's just individuals. But lynching as a whole is a very broad stroke, and it I agree with him very much. So it is definitely a very broad stroke and encompasses so many aspects of our experience. And one thing that EJI did, in addition to the numbers they currently possess in their narrative report, is they looked at the impact of trauma and terrorism. They call these lynchings racial terror lynchings because they recognize that these were designed to terrorize the African American community, to stay in a subordination status in society based upon race and hierarchy of ethnocentrism. So they don't discount that. And I imagine that, I mean, the EJI has so many aspects to what they look at, from incarceration to children incarcerated, particularly brown and black kids. So I imagine the research probably perhaps becoming more extensive in that regard. But I just wanted to acknowledge that lynching does surpass just the noose.
I want to add something.
Is that a question right here?
Yeah, and I will not touch your mic. And it's more of a couple of statements. Yeah, that's awesome. All we need is love. No. we need a lot more than just love. Getting on your knee and everything is not going to do nothing. You know, you could pray all you want, but that's not doing anything. Second, I sort of almost like agree with you with you, like, oh, we can't tell people to disavow anything, but... I've heard a couple of times from people who I end up, because obviously I'm from New York too. I know everything about everything. So I get into arguments with people, and I've been told that first what's going on, this is all because us Northerners are coming down here and changing things and trying to like vote so like whatever. They can't have their friggin' rebel flag.
Yankees.
Yeah, damn Yankee is a Yankee that won't go home. They need to disavow some things, like, you know, being honest about what is their the rebel, and what's it actually called? The rebel flag that I see on the trucks that makes
the
me go, ooh,
flag?
I don't like you.
Confederate flag.
Confederate flag.
Dixie.
Yeah, when they go and tell me, oh, you don't, you, it's heritage, not hate. Oh, screw you.
Right.
It's hate. And even if you don't think it's hate, if someone else feels it's hateful, why is it so hard to, like, not stick it on the back of your pickup truck?
Right.
So, you know, I get, like, we have to, like, be friendly and we have to be
accepting. Well, I didn't necessarily mean we had to be friendly, but understanding people's heritage, but also being able to engage them. You know, if there's, excuse me, someone who's flying, who's walking around with a rebel flag on their shirt and has certain feelings about me, you know, I think it's easier for me to engage them if I see them as a person. I see you as a person. If I know you and I know you are whatever your character traits are and where we have some commonality, I can probably best reach you through that approach than to stop you at the door and say, you know, get out of here because, you know, you're so different and you're coming in to cause trouble, blah, blah, blah. I can deal, well, I guess maybe I'm old enough now to be able to deal with some of that. But I'd rather try to reach the person within, because I think we're all, you know, like in Shrek. He said, people are like onions, right? We got layers. So I think we all got layers. We are all a lot of things. But at the center of it all, we need to recognize humanity. And I think it's there in everybody. Now, it's harder to get to it in some people than others. Don't get me wrong. And as James Cone said, you know, loving God is one thing, but loving white people is a whole other. So, so you know.
Now, and you make a good point, and I know we have several other people out here in the audience, but I have another question that I want to ask directed towards the panel, and then, of course, we're all in this discussion again. But what are the differences between subjective experience of acknowledging painful history if you're a person of color versus white?
Explain that a little more.
Okay. So what are the differences, I'll repeat it, what are the differences between the subjective experience of acknowledging the painful history, and I'll say if you're a person of color, as in contrast to being a white person. So let's say if you're black and you're envisioning something like this, you're seeing, let's talk about it from your perspective, but I also want to talk about it, I want to hear from some white people in the audience, like what do you envision? How do you take this from a subjective context? What do you see? What do you feel if we're talking about this in discussion?
Well, I often feel like, especially, which I often am in circles like this, one or few black people or people of color in a room, I feel the weight and the pressure to speak for all black people, right? And this expectation that what I say, I'm speaking. Now, in some ways, yes, with a resoundance, there is a collective spirit to the struggle and the triumph. I think any ethnic group or race of people or gender of people can speak to that. So that's one thing I don't like. And sometimes I take the honor that the fact that I have a seat at the table and I am present to give a voice to the voiceless or to the story or the narrative. So there are times when I will step up and I will speak or I will share, but I oftentimes will preface it with I, because I can only speak from what I've experienced, right? And how I internalize things. I saw the Harriet film recently, this past weekend. I saw it twice. I saw it with Debbie and I saw it with my brother and Debbie's friend. And it was a powerful film. And as a person of color and a woman, it just had me thinking a lot, just like I think about when I watch Roots or when I watch any type of film dealing with really hard dehumanization, just obviously evilness, you know, that human beings would inflict on other human beings. And it just makes me, you know, angry and sad, a mixture of emotions. Sometimes surreal is what it seems like, you know, to think or to fathom that my ancestors went through such atrocities. It also reminds me how strong and resilient my ancestors are, and the human spirit to endure such and to continue to hold on to hope to get us to where we are today. So it's so much, it's a mosaic. I mean, I feel similar to Byron when I walk through the Legacy Museum, when you walk in, there are holograms of enslaved people, children, mothers, fathers calling out, singing. And it's situated on Commercial or Commerce Street, right, which it formerly was a place of enslavement, right. And enslaved people were actually present there in years past. And so I don't think you can ever really be totally non-affected by it, you know? It's so ingrained in the fabric of our society. You don't need to know all to just know. You know enough. You experience enough that it's with you. And so it's something that we all have to wrestle with. And I think to ignore it is to ignore the truth. Like the gentleman was saying, we have to acknowledge the truth. And if we want to truly connect and grow and mature as a nation, you have to be willing to wrestle with the truth. And the truth, you know, it stands alone. It's just a matter of embracing it.
Yeah. One of the things that struck me most at the museum, I forgot what section I was in, but there was a person saying that, you know, the whips, you know, that he got whipped with were nothing in comparison to when they took his child away from him. Mm-hmm. And as a father, that resonated with me. And I said, oh, my God, this is horrible, because I can only imagine someone taking my child away from me. And I think many of us can have sentiments like that. So it's at that level. The lynching, to me, is about our humanity. It's about, or the lack thereof. It is indeed a means to control by diminishing one's humanity and striking fear in them. And oftentimes, I believe we may have learned, I can't remember now, that, you know, with lynchings, the person who was actually lynched, you know, it didn't just affect them, but it was the whole family. Right. Oftentimes the family had to move. There's no closure.
Yeah, the
community.
You
know, there's these open wounds that people carry generation after generation after generation. And I do agree with you about the wider net that lynching is. This project is focusing just on one piece. But, you know, but just the humanity aspect of it is what really has driven me to be a part of this activity.
Comments from the audience.
Hi, my name is Katrina Rivers. I'm a healthcare professional. And thank you, Dr. Hollyfield, for your comments. And I just wanted to kind of address something. The lady who spoke after him that spoke to cortisol levels and to the fact that the individual who experienced the loss of the child or the maternal mortality, yes, social determinants of health, those things that impact you based on where you live, your environment, your access to healthy foods, your access to care, yes, that can impact. But there are also there is also the encounter that you have with the healthcare professional. If you think about somebody like Serena Williams, who's a millionaire, billionaire, she's married, and she's married to a white man. She almost died after giving birth because the staff didn't want to hear her concerns about her own health. And so that was based on somebody's implicit or unconscious biases. And so those are the things that impact how we experience situations that we should otherwise move through smoothly, but we can't. And so we, as people in general, need to learn how to be aware of those biases that we have. And they come from our life experiences. I mean, it is not only just a racial situation. I mean, I could have been pushed off the monkey bars at age 7 by a redhead. So as an adult, when I see a redhead person, I'm like, I don't like them. Mm-hmm. You know, it's subtle. It sounds comical, but it's subtle. Mm-hmm. But it leads to great, great disparity, especially on the healthcare front. And those things need to be addressed. And people who work in that profession and work in professions like law enforcement should have to be trained to be mindful of those biases and how to respond to them and treat people appropriately at each encounter.
Okay, we got one here, and then we're going to come back here, and then we'll go to the panel.
Okay. Three things. As far as the like love. Like, I guess on the coming end, like we all know and like desire to evolve, to come to a place of unconditional love. But, you know, honestly, no relationship can sustain with just love, whether that's a friendship, marriage, like it takes, you know, other things with that. And so with understanding love, a lot of this is based in memory. Because when you think about trauma, it's based in memory. So picking back off when you said, like, we're focusing on the current, I'm also talking from, I'm an art therapist, so I'm talking from an art therapist perspective and racial trauma perspective. Saying the current as a therapist to hear that erases the necessity of the past, because the idea is that everybody in this room is not just born like in this year where we can start in the current. A lot of people have grandmothers and aunts that are of age, and because of that memory, those behavior patterns, those social norms, mechanisms, all those things are passed down through the generation. And so we have to consider the past and not necessarily erasing the memory, because it's not going to go anywhere, but definitely recreating the memory. Even within this room, honestly, the way this room is set up should be reconsidered, because the structure alone already creates barriers. And again, that's something very subtle, but that's something that I'm paying attention to, because it decreases the ability to me to see who I'm standing with and create the oxytocin, you know, to, you know, to move forward. When you were stating that, you know, we shouldn't force white people to like disown the people that, you know, they may be associated with it, that has done wrong or whatever. And again, I think that roots back to being empathetic and having empathy. But the narrative for black people where it becomes problematic is that society has created this narrative for black people to unconditionally, indirectly, and directly disown one another due to systems that white people have set in place due to institutionalized racism. And so from there trying to move forward, we are not often given that chance to keep that connection with people who do wrong or, you know, fail. If we personally like want to do that, yes, but I'm talking from a community perspective. We're not given that chance to reconcile from things that started because society forces us to reach like this unachievable success, and certain things come with that in your behavior, and you have to, you know, be like that. And so moving forward, I just think that along with community conversations needs to be community creation, meaning that we need to bring back creativity, because creativity pushes us to a very, very vulnerable childlike state. And when we can create with one another, we can have those intimate conversations and apply that creation to policy and, you know, law and things of that nature. Because right now, everybody's operating off a logical brain.
So that's a really good point. And I'm gonna make a comment as Eliza makes it back to someone here. I see you.
Let me just say
yes, sir.
Now, I just want to make it clear, I wasn't saying give white people a pass. Okay, I just don't want you to say that. Yeah. But I think it needs to go both ways.
For sure.
You know?
And I think I want to, and Bland, and we may be on the same wavelength, because I was going to come to you earlier in the discussion when we began to talk about the objectives of the project. We talked about reconciliation, and we talked about how we even saw that maybe reconciliation was more of a weighted word. And I wanted to talk to you, Bland. I wanted you to weigh in on that in context of what type of reconciliation are we seeing in this project, and is that even the way we want to address what this project means, reconciliation?
Well, I think we're seeing an increasing awareness. I'm going to kind of circle back to your previous question about the subjective experience of black people and white people.
Please.
I'm going to tie it in with that. I'm going to talk about the subjective experience of white people. And I really appreciate Dr. Holyfield's comments and Takesha's comments, because one of the things that I've encountered from some white people, and I cannot speak on behalf of all white people, I can only speak on behalf of myself, but one of the things I've encountered in this project is the subjective experience of some white people is not to recognize the current objective reality. And so where I have encountered pockets of resistance among my white friends, they have said, can't we just get along? Can't we just move forward? Can't we move toward a post-racial society? Aren't you going to open these wounds? Isn't this going to make people uncomfortable? To which I responded, I hope it makes some people a little bit uncomfortable, especially white people, frankly. because we don't, Takesha talked about Black people have these conversations. Fortunately, and I think this project assists with that, white people are starting to have conversations about, no, you didn't personally do it because it's in the past, although it's not very ancient history. And one of the things that we're having to confront is we are the beneficiaries of structural, institutional racism that was set in place by white people to perpetuate the privilege of white people. And it's been very good for me to have to face up to that and confront that and realize, I may not think that I'm a millionaire and I may not think that I've had all of the benefits of the system, but I've certainly had a whole lot of benefits of the system that I didn't see,
right,
that I wasn't aware of. Mm-hmm. And white people have had the luxury of not even having to talk about this because our ancestors, they designed the game. And so when I was a child, I didn't have to wake up in the morning thinking about I'm white. And now I really do have to think about that and what that means. And I have to think about, I think the word is not reconciliation, but in Tallahassee, Leon County, for example, I think about 29 to 30% of our community is African American. I have some relationships with African American people in this community, but there are barriers that we need to get past, and those barriers have to do with my facing up to and confronting and having the truth spoken to me, and not just understanding it, but accepting it. And then, as Leonard Pitts said, structural, institutional white racism isn't Black people's problem. It's white people's problem, and y'all gotta fix it. And I don't think we can fix it alone. I think we have to fix it in partnership and community with you. But this project, whether it finally comes to fruition or not, if it generates conversations like this, and if it generates tough conversations within the white community about the extremely uncomfortable past that we have to confront in St. John's history, my own church, we have to recognize that. We have to talk about it. Because if we don't talk about it, we can never have complete, full relationships.
Thank you so much. Mm-hmm. Eliza.
What Bland said, yes.
Maybe I'm speaking on behalf of all white people. No.
Well, two of us, yeah. So in something I was reading, I think maybe it was Devil in the Grove, I discovered an ancestor. The Black man was not killed, but he was a decorated World War II veteran that was going from Augusta, Georgia to Columbia, South Carolina. And the sheriff in a county, three counties over from where my grandmother with that same maiden name was, he wanted to go to he was at a bus, the bus stopped, he wanted to go to the bathroom. They didn't want to let him go to the bathroom. The sheriff beat him blind. Okay, and that man has the same last name as my grandmother three counties over. I never knew him, I never knew the connection, but that really, really came home. And that's in the past. I'm a Quaker. Presbyterians lynched Quakers in Boston. You know, there's a bronze of one of the Quaker women that the Presbyterians lynched. Here, we need to bring that monument from Montgomery that they'll give us. When I went there, they have created a holy place. I can relate to it. I was there with you, Brian. When you said you went back to your room and
yeah. mm-hmm.
Byron, I'm not, I'm
yeah.
sorry.
Mm-hmm. I know.
Brian Stevenson is a genius. that duplicate has to leave there and come here.
You've been listening to a delayed broadcast of the Village Square's community discussion on race held at the Junction at Monroe on November 14, 2019. Be sure to join us again next time for another visit to the Village Square on WFSU Public Media.